Hello, welcome to Civil Defense Radio with your host, Preston Schleinkofer. On the line today, we have Tim McWelch. He's a survival instructor. He's got over 20 years doing this. He's trained U.S. Armed Forces, Department of State, Department of Justice, and he's also an author. He's got 7 survival manuals out there. 3 of them are New York Times bestsellers, and I believe he may be involved in his 8th book. Welcome to the show, Tim.
Hey, Preston. Thank you for having me. I really appreciate the opportunity.
It's a pleasure having you, especially a fellow Virginian.
Yeah. There are lots of us in the survival arena and self-reliance arena, but you know, there's also a lot of folks doing this that aren't native sons of the Old Dominion. So glad to help you.
Yeah, I'm not a native son either. I came here in 2011 from the great state of Texas, but my wife has been domiciled here for many years, so I adopted it as my home too. Doesn't look like we're going to be leaving anytime soon either, so might as well make the best of it, right?
Yeah. And hey, you're a Texan. We'll take a Texan.
Well, I was a transplanted Texan. I grew up in Oregon.
Oh, well, now you're just confusing me. So you definitely weren't a Yankee when you were from Texas, but I don't know what Oregon is.
Well, when I was in Texas, they said it was the Northwest County of Texas. So you can figure. I like to say I grew up in Oregon and grew old in Texas, and now I'm getting older in Virginia.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's a good place to get older.
Yeah.
I love it here. I've traveled a lot, and I don't want to be anywhere else.
Yeah, it is really a nice state. I've got to see quite a bit of it, and I'm pretty happy. I like the weather, too, except for the winter. I'm not really a winter guy. That's why I enjoyed Texas so much. But it was a change moving here, having seasons and having the ice and snow, which I didn't have in San Antonio.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, a little culture shock for you, but that's the price you pay to have you know, beautiful fall and all this green growth we have here in spring.
Oh, yeah, it's fantastic. It reminds me of growing up in Oregon. It's warmer here, which is better, I think. So, Tim, can you tell us how you got started being a survival instructor? How did that transition take place?
Yeah, you know, it's kind of an unusual career path. A lot of people that do what I do have a military background, and they, you know, they went up, they rose to the ranks, they trained in different areas, and you know, a lot of times people that end up teaching survival skills, you know, the SEER instructors and these other elite individuals, once they transition out of the armed forces, then they've got all this survival knowledge, and they're like, well, you know, now what do I do? So some of those folks start survival schools for civilians, and some of them continue to work with the armed forces. And I did not take that typical track. I don't know anybody else who's done it the way that I did it. So I got started in survival and self-reliance just through my upbringing. Grew up here in Virginia on a farm. You know, we always took advantage of what was available that season. So we would take full advantage of plants that we could forage, wild plants, and we grew gardens and canned vegetables, and we've almost always had some kind of livestock on the family farm. And so that, you know, that really made an impression on me growing up. And my father he's always been the guy who could fix anything. There's an electrical problem, he's on it. He's ripping wires out of the walls, and he's figuring it out, and he's fixing it. He was a welder, a farmer, you know, he, along the line, he learned to be a plumber and an electrician and a engineer and a carpenter and everything else. And so, you know, seeing somebody so well-rounded in their ability to provide for themselves and their family, you know, that also made an impression on me. And so over the years, you know, I've done everything I could to pick up lots of different skills and just have, you know, have more than one card up my sleeve at any given time. So growing up on the farm, I was always very, very interested in the outdoors. I love to play outside and go pick blackberries in the summer and go fishing and all that kind of stuff. And so that foundation was there for a love of nature, a love of the outdoors. When I became a teenager, I wanted to branch out. I wanted to have a little bit of, autonomy. I wanted to be able to do my own thing. Then I started hiking and camping and backpacking, either solo or with friends from school. And I never had any horrible setting where, somebody's hurt and we're in a survival situation. That never happened. But I could see the writing on the wall. I realized that with enough exposure, that risk grows greater. Mm-hmm. And so the more we went out and the more trips we took and the more we pared down our gear to carry less and less and less, it was just putting us in a greater position to end up in an emergency. Now, I'm dating myself a little bit. The time when we were starting to get into ultralight backpacking and all this kind of stuff, this was pre-cell phone. I'm sure a lot of the younger audience can't even fathom what that's like. They can't imagine not having a mobile phone in your pocket. I had one of those. I had one of like the earliest flip phones. It was just a little smaller than the big gray brick that everybody carried around when cell phones first became a thing. So this little chunk, I still have it. It's like half of a brick, and then it had a little flip over piece that covered the buttons. And so I thought that was the coolest thing when I first had one of those in my early 20s, because now I could be outdoors and I could call for help if something went wrong. But that technology didn't exist yet, or at least it wasn't affordable and available when I was starting to get into backpacking and all that. Mm-hmm. And I realized at one point, if I get hurt, I'm out here, there's no practical way to get help. I can blow whistles and flash mirrors and all that kind of stuff, but I need to have some survival skills. I needed to know what to do if I was on my own for a while. And that's what began this lifelong quest to learn, every facet of survival that I could.
So you went to various courses to learn some of the things that you have developed expertise in, as well as just personal experience?
Yeah. Loads of book research and then taking it out into the field and seeing what worked and what didn't from these books that we've all probably read or seen at least. And then I have taken some classes at different schools throughout the country. Some were great, some were awful, some were cults. the survival school, as an entity, can run the whole gamut. There's some amazing instructors out there who have a legitimate background in education and they know how to present material and they're giving you information that works and it's useful. And then there are just plenty of crackpots, just nut jobs that have taken advantage of the rise in interest in survival and they're just, just going on about nonsense, and they're relating information that may or may not work. And so over the years, I had the opportunity to study from, lots of different people and see what I wanted to continue spreading, what kind of information actually works and what I wanted to share. And then I've seen how not to run a class. And how not to run a school and how not to present yourself, to people who trust you. When people come to me, whether they're coming to my class, or whether they're reading my books, they're trusting me to give them stuff that will work and it would have repeatable results. And so I don't take that lightly. I don't take that lightly at all.
If somebody's paying you to give them that knowledge, it should be good knowledge.
Even if they're not paying me, Preston, if you're hanging up your shingle as a survival instructor, and let's say you've made a bunch of YouTube videos or whatever the format is, even if you're doing free programs at the park,
right?
Even if they don't pay, they still, everybody deserves to have legitimate information that actually works, because they're, you know, you never know when somebody's life is going to depend on it.
Right. Right. So, what was your, you've got 7 survival manuals. And I think I remember reading that you were working on number 8. Is that right?
Yeah. I've started kind of laying just a few little groundwork pieces for an 8th book. So we'll see if anything materializes here in 2019. We may not have an 8th book put together and available till next year. And that's okay. You know, it's not a process you want to rush, and you know, you want to make sure everything fits and all the pieces are lined up. But I'm actually thinking about number 8. So the opportunity to write books has just been a godsend. You know, it's one of those things that not everybody gets to do, and so I really appreciate the opportunity that Outdoor Life magazine has afforded me. I've been writing for them mostly doing online content for quite a few years now. You know, it won't be too many more years until I've been with them for 10 years. I think we started around maybe 2010, 2011, working with Outdoor Life magazine. And I think I did a magazine article for the printed magazine in 2010. And then I think the online content started in 2011. Don't quote me on that. I've written so much stuff for them for so long, hundreds and hundreds of blogs and all these photo galleries and all that stuff. And that's still up there, guys. You can look at that by going to outdoorlife.com and just look up my name, Tim MacWelch, MacWelch. And you'll see photo galleries pop up. You'll see all these blogs that are just on every survival topic you could imagine. So they've got all that content on the website.
Well, that's pretty good. If somebody wanted to just get into some basic survival information, which book would you recommend they go to?
You know, that depends on what their concerns are and what their interests are. So the first book I wrote, Prepare for Anything, that was the one that really shocked us all. I guess the timing was right, and that rascal became a New York Times bestseller. And we didn't know about it for a couple of months until somebody mentioned it to somebody, and then that went to the publisher, and they're like, oh, my God, yeah, look at the list. So then they got back to me, and I was just blown away. I couldn't believe it. I mean, that's a goal that probably 99% of the writers out there, you know, it's a goal that they desperately want to reach, but you know, a lot of them don't ever get there. And so, you know, it just fell into place. I don't know how to say it any other way. It's like it was meant to be, but, that's a great introductory book for someone who's interested in wilderness survival, disaster preparedness, just being more resilient and more self-reliant. There's a little bit of everything in that book. So we talk about the supplies and material items that people should have for various emergencies. We talk about the skills that people should learn and you know, just how to integrate all that together. I mean, the supplies are great, but they're not so great if you don't know how to use them. And the skills are great, but sometimes they really need the supplies to work correctly and to work, you know, quickly. Like you could, just for example, Preston, you could improvise a tourniquet, right? I mean, you could, you know, take a belt off and, right, you know, find a stick and, you know, start twisting and all that. But the time it takes you to assess the problem, to cobble together all this random junk, and maybe the first stick you try to twist breaks, you know, so then you got to grab another, you know, bigger stick. And in that time, somebody could have lost consciousness from bleeding. An exsanguinating hemorrhage can drain the body of blood. in just a matter of minutes. And so, you know, it might take you a couple minutes to piece together some kind of improvised tourniquet. Or, you know, if you've planned ahead, you've got a good quality tourniquet right in the top of your medical bag. You don't want it buried at the bottom. You want the stuff that matters in seconds, not minutes or hours, but seconds. You want the stuff like that right on the top of the bag. So you grab a cat tourniquet or a SWAT tee or whatever you've trained yourself to use, and you know, I've got it down 15 seconds. Oh, I can apply a tourniquet to myself and crank it down in 15 seconds. Now I know it's coming, you know, and the thing's in my hand, but I can do it pretty quick, and I think everybody should be able to do it that quick, because you could lose consciousness in a minute or less if the bleeding is bad enough.
Right.
To have a combination, a synergy between skills and supplies, you know, that's where you get into this window of opportunity where people can survive some of the most horrific and unexpected events. And you know, that's what this is really all about. It's having the right stuff and the knowledge of how to use it.
Yeah, and that's very important. Medical, a lot of people forget about medical issues or medical training. You know, basic first aid and CPR and how to stop the bleeding, stuff like that is paramount when you're just every day. You know, I've noticed that our fire department is starting to put on classes for CPR and first aid on a regular basis now. I think every quarter they're showing up on the list as giving those classes. So that's very important for people to avail themselves of such training. It could save somebody in their family's life.
Yeah. You know, I've told my classes this for years, and just the past month, I've harped on it a bunch of times to different classes. Whatever they were out there for, you know, people come out to see me and they want to learn some modern wilderness survival skills, or they want to do some primitive technology, or, you know, whatever their interest is. You know, I have classes throughout the year.
Uh-huh.
And, so just about any subject that people come out for, I'm going to get on a soapbox and let them know if they don't get some medical training, they're crazy. You know, first aid skills and you know, these, you know, bleeding control and different, you know, CPR, different life-saving skills are the most likely survival skills that anybody will ever use in their entire life. I mean, how many times have you had to rub two sticks together to make a fire?
Never.
die? Never. Yeah, I can't find anything. I mean, I can do it. I love doing that. We're teaching a class on friction fire this coming Friday. It's a lot of fun. It's not as hard as you'd think. And you know, it's an amazing skill set. And I've never had to do it to save anyone's life.
Right.
And I don't know of anybody who's ever had to do it to save anybody's life. I don't know of anybody within the past couple of centuries. You know, I don't know of any survival stories where it came down to rubbing two sticks together.
Yeah.
I don't know of a single one. If somebody knows of one, please let me know. I definitely want to research that and add that to my bag of tricks, but I suspect it'll just be, you know, just a few, if any, over the past, you know, let's say 100 years.
Yeah, but so, practicing CPR basic first aid, Heimlich maneuver, all those have saved people's lives on a almost daily basis around the country.
Yeah. And so that's the most likely, you know, survival stuff that you'll ever put to use. Someone's survival is at stake.
Exactly.
You know, if they're having a heart attack, if a child is choking, you know, if somebody's cut themselves really bad and you know, they just nicked the wrong artery and, you know, blood's just flying out onto the floor. Yeah, these are the skills that really do save people.
Yeah.
Not so much, you know, not so much the, rubbing two sticks together or eating weeds. Although I do teach that and we have a lot of fun with it.
Dandelion leaves and roots.
Oh, yeah. It's good stuff, man. Deep fry that flour. It's amazing.
All right. We've got some dandelion leaves in the fridge right now. I want to switch to the reaction you get when people tell you you're a survival instructor? What types of reactions do people give you? And is it just their lack of information that causes them many times to wonder why you would do something like that? Can you tell us a little bit more?
That's a great question, Preston. I don't get asked that very often. That's a very insightful question. So when people, you know, I meet people somewhere, whether it's, you know, at a school function that, you know, my children's school, you know, the parents come together, or, you know, whether I just meet people out in public, or, you know, a friend of the family comes over, something like that. And, you know, a typical American thing is, you know, so what do you do? What do you do for a living? And then I, you know, I try to explain myself. Well, you know, I'm a survival instructor, and I'm also an author in that subject. And from the word survival, their eyes become bigger, and they look startled. They look alarmed. You know, they look shocked.
They try to run away.
Not what they expected. They expected me to say that, okay, well, you know, I do something with computers, or I am a carpenter, or, you know, I drive a garbage truck. These are the things people expect you to say when they ask that question of you. And when I tell them survival instructor, they take on this deer in the headlights look. Now, 90% of them don't follow up the question. They are frightened. They immediately assume that I'm some kind of gun nut. And I say that in a loving way. I you know, I'm a big supporter of firearms rights and the Second Amendment. And when I say gun nut, we all know the gun nuts. These are people who love it a little too much. And so they assume that I'm that, and I live in some sort of cave or bunker or some underground lair.
Super
prepper. They just don't follow up. They don't want to know. Now, you know, so that's like 90% of people's reactions. Now, 10% will shift from alarm and then kind of drift into surprise, and then they'll kind of, their eyes will light up, and they'll be like, wow, you know, that's pretty cool. You know, that's interesting. And interesting is a big word. You know, oh, that's interesting. That's so interesting. You know, that's a great way to say nothing. Tell people, oh, that's interesting. So, you know, and then probably, you know, just a fraction of that 10% are like, wow, you know, that's something I've always wanted to know, you know, and then they follow it up. If there's an apocalypse, I'm coming to your house.
Right.
That's you know, that's the response of somebody who's not alarmed by my day job. You know, they of course naturally will glom onto me and say, oh, well, if anything happens, you know, I'm coming to see you.
I've had people tell me that too.
yeah. And that's not what you want to hear. I mean, it's sweet and endearing and naive and childlike to say something like that. Like, okay, yeah, I'll just take care of everybody. Why don't all of you just come to my house? I'll take care of you. You know, but once you get past the childlike magical thinking, you know, of these people, then you realize that man, they're vulnerable.
Oh yeah.
They are so vulnerable to make a statement like that. Some friends of mine have a broad client base for a healthcare business. Mm-hmm. And on 9/11, they had about a half a dozen of their clients just show up at their office. They didn't have any treatments scheduled that day. They just knew that this gentleman and his wife who run this medical business, they knew that they were preppers and they had, you know, food and water, and, you know, they kind of knew what to do if anything bad ever happened. And, you know, when the first couple people rolled into the office, my friends were shocked. But then they thought, well, you know, I mean, that's kind of nice. You know, they think that we're squared away and that we can take care of them. But then after, you know, half a dozen people were just sitting around the waiting room and they weren't supposed to be there, this couple realized that these people are helpless and they're just, you know, utterly dependent on someone else. And that wasn't really a good realization. They realized that, you know what? I mean, this is not really flattering. This is a bit of a burden.
Yeah.
You know, they've got this expectation that, you know, because they have a business relationship that they'll just get this inside, this inside knowledge and this inside treatment. And so that was kind of an interesting story, from my students, you know, how people had, reacted that day. And of course, you know, that's an infamous day. I mean, that's a day that's going to live on in everybody's minds. And, you know, it still hurts to think about. And it's just, you know, it's a situation that we don't ever want to see repeated again.
Yes.
But it's, you know, it's one of those heavy, dark, gloomy subjects that, you know, at least we can learn something from it. You know, or even a non-event like Y2K. I mean, nothing happened and that was a non-event, but a lot of people, you know, they did learn something from that. Sadly, a lot of people learned the wrong lesson, like, oh, nothing's going to happen ever, so I'm not going to prepare. But other people learn more valuable lessons, like, hey, you know what? You know, we just panic bought and ran out and bought all this crap, you know, and now, you know, all these canned goods have gone bad, you know, and we're just going to have to throw them out, and we wasted our money, and, you know, we didn't get the right stuff, or, you know, the stuff we got was gross, you know, maybe you bought a bunch of, you know, cheap, you know, freeze-dried food from an off-brand, you know, and it's like stuff you can't even
or
eat.
Or cases of Cheese Whiz or something.
yeah, you know, the pallet of Cheese Whiz and the, you know, Costco 55-gallon drums of mayonnaise. I mean, you know, you just can't eat that much in the sitting.
Yeah.
You know, people learn these things from Y2K, and you know, I like to think, you know, it helped rather than hurt. But you know, that's a million years ago in people's minds. You know, that's a whole adult ago, Preston.
You're right.
That's an entire voting age adult ago.
Yeah.
So a lot of people don't even really remember it. But so when people ask me what I do, they assume that I'm some sort of brass and lead crazed maniac living in some, you know, bizarre hovel somewhere, and you know, that I'm just waiting for the zombies to come. That's another big thing is
zombie,
you know,
apocalypse
by zombie. So the people assume that that's what I've, you know, made a living off of, and that's what I'm preparing people for. Not so much.
Yeah. You know, I remember Y2K and 9/11, and I was off on 9/11. You know, you said that people remember where they were. I was off that day. I was working swing shift. I was in the Border Patrol at the time down in South Texas. And I woke up and I saw the news on TV about the airplanes hitting the Twin Towers. And I called into the office. I said, hey, what's going on? They go, nothing. I said, we're not in any expanded condition or anything. They go, no, why? They were oblivious. You know, my military training told me, you know, you gotta fortify, you know, your area and you know, get everything ready in case something happens and in case somebody has to be sent somewhere or whatever, because the Border Patrol is the Marine Corps of federal law enforcement, and so they were always sending us someplace, and especially being on the response team, so we were always going somewhere So it was interesting that that nobody had any concept of what was going on on a national level, just what was going on locally, and so some of that carried forward to my moving to the DC area and working at headquarters ICE. I was on the continuity of operations team, and I was given a access card to a secret location up in Virginia Mountains. And, you know, I just gotten married, and my wife, I told her about it. She goes, well, what about me? And I go, oh, crap. So that started me on my quest to look around for what resources were available to John and Jane Smith. Mm-hmm. And I realized there was nothing. There was no civil defense. There was nothing. It was all about continuity of government. Oh, when government finally gets around to getting their act together, they'll come and save you if they can. Well, mm-hmm. that mad theology is what I call it. It's mutually assured destruction that was borrowed from the nuclear deterrent strategy, transitioned into our emergency management field. And so there's nothing for the average individual on how to prepare. There's very little. Sure, you got to have 72 hours worth of food and water and stuff in case, you know, something happens, and then wait for government to come protect you, come find you and save you. Well, that hasn't worked out very well in the last 15 years. And I'm sure you have plenty of stories from your students on things that are similar to that.
Yeah, you know, I've got a friend in the State Department, and he started out as a student, and you know, now we're good friends. Just, you know, you meet so many like-minded people when you're in this arena, and so, you know, he and I have both been very concerned about his family when he's deployed.
Yes.
So, you know, when he's doing his job overseas, you know, he didn't want to scare his wife too much. He didn't want to, you know, upset his children any more than they already were, you know, are upset from, you know, dad having to go to some scary place,
right,
you know, for undisclosed reasons. But, you know, we've talked about it and, you know, we've worked on it, and, you know, it's just something. It's something I think every head of household. It doesn't have to be dad,
right?
Lady, step up, ladies. You know, the moms. You're in it for 50%. You know, it doesn't have to be dad being the traditional male provider. I'm going to get the guns and the ammo and you know, the beans and the blankets and all that kind of stuff. If the man of the house isn't interested in taking care of you and the kids, then you take care of you and the kids. You know, squirrel away some stuff from every grocery trip.
Right.
And have water, have ready to eat food, you know, so that you can just crack open cans or open up boxes, and you don't even need the utilities.
Yes.
To get that meal ready, just, you know, ready to eat. I love stuff you can even eat while you're walking. You know, it doesn't have to be power bars or granola bars or any other kind of bars, but just think of foods that have a long shelf life, have a lot of calories, and you could eat it while you're walking if you had to.
Yes.
That's definitely a no-cook food. And so, you know, these are things that can just be squirreled away, you know, just a few packages a week. And next thing you know, you'll have your 72-hour kit all done, and then you'll have, you know, a two-week kit wrapped up, and then you can just push out further from there. And it should be stuff that you regularly eat, stuff that kids will eat, you know, stuff that's a long time, and stuff that you can rotate into your normal food supply.
Yes.
You know, if you don't rotate it, if you don't use it, you're just wasting your money. You're going to have to throw it away at some point, and that feels bad, and it is bad.
Yeah.
So get stuff that you know, would at least be turned into lunches or you know, something like that. But yeah, man. I mean, people need to take their own resiliency seriously.
Yeah, it's their responsibility. You're right.
What I've seen over the past 2 years has really bothered me and a bunch of my colleagues and my friends and my students. There has been a sharp drop off in the interest in self-reliance as far as like disaster preparedness goes. Let's call it what it is. The prepper, the interest in being a prepper and that type of preparedness thinking has really dropped off. And I think what we've seen is a shift, and the people that maybe were preppers before, they've switched gears and maybe they're interested in more of like the homesteader stuff now.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's still self-reliance. It's just not so gloom and doom. You can't eat gloom and doom for breakfast, lunch, and dinner. You know, it'll drive you crazy. And I think that's what we're seeing. I haven't really been able to figure it out, but all I know is that I've had a lot less people interested in preparedness type classes over the past 2 years. A shocking drop in interest. And this is where I'm seeing people going. You know, people are either they're going to discontinue preparedness altogether, or they're going to switch gears and look at something a little more wholesome and not quite so scary, and maybe kind of get into the homesteader thing. And it's a weird blurred line right now. You know, some of the preppers I know, I mean, they're doing all the homesteader stuff. You know, they're mm-hmm. raising chickens and growing the vegetables and all that kind of stuff. And they're having fun with it, and they're getting some good food out of the deal. You know, the prepper stuff, I mean, they haven't thrown away, you know, their Mountain House food and their bullets and stuff, but, you know, that's really not the focus anymore. What do you think about that, Preston? What are you seeing?
I think that there's a definite transition that's going on. A lot of people, I think when you first get into preparedness, there's a tendency to go towards that, you know, I don't like to disparage the word prepper because I'm a prepper, but people tend to go after certain things that they think they have to have right now. Whereas in actuality, you should be building your resiliency, your family resiliency, your neighborhood resiliency, your community resiliency through smart actions like you mentioned: food, water, medical, sanitation, safety, and cooking. You know, being able to cook with in a grid down, whether it's 3 days or 2 weeks or whatever. I recommend 14 days minimum of preparedness, but I would rather see everybody have 30 days. But going back to your original question, I think we are under the Trump effect. After President Trump, I don't like being political in my show here, but I think after Trump was elected, the gun sales dropped. I have three friends that are in the gun industry, and all their sales dropped dramatically until recently they've started coming back up. But I think there was a lot of people that went, and so there's a little more calm in the genre for more homesteading stuff and getting more well-rounded in their idea of being resilient and prepared. I know people who have their bug out spots. You know, they've got a cabin off someplace, and you know, they go out there on, you know, one weekend a month or whatever. It's you know, there's a whole scale of people being prepared that they've calmed down and haven't seen that rush need to be prepared. And probably to some degree, they've gotten a lot of the stuff that they needed as far as their food and stuff like that. Now they're transitioning to that homesteading, which is the gardening and learning how to do that right, and raising animals like goats and chickens and rabbits, and composting. Composting is important. I see some of that going on.
Yeah, I agree with you 100%. I think you explained that really well. I'm sure other people have used the Trump effect phrase for other reasons or whatever, but. But yeah, I think that's what it is. I really do. My classes just stopped booking after the presidential election results came out, and they've been super slow. You know, booking for classes, whatever class, has been really slow for the past 2 years. And you know, I've been in this industry for you know, I've been teaching survival classes since 1997 for adults. And I've been teaching this subject matter. I started with kids groups and Boy Scouts and stuff in 1995. So I've been teaching this stuff for a very long time, and I've seen lots of peaks and valleys. And, you know, of course, you know, 2012 was a peak. You know, that was all hyped up and pumped up, and, you know, we had lots of people want to do classes that year. And then, you know, it dropped off a little bit, but then it came back. And, but then, you know, pre-election, you know, people were really concerned. People were worried about the future. They were worried about the well-being of themselves and their families.
Yes.
So they bought the stuff.
Mm-hmm.
They bought the supplies. They bought the training. They bought the firearms. They bought the ammo. And, you know, they were showing with their dollars what they were interested in and worried about. And then, I think in this area, you know, here in the Mid-Atlantic, I think, you know, all the Beltway preppers just sighed a big sigh of relief. I think a lot of preparedness minded people ended up being conservative people. And when their guy won, they just put their feet up and had a drink with a little umbrella in it and just breathed a sigh of relief and said, oh man, I'm good. I'm covered.
Yeah.
I don't have to worry about a thing for the next 4 years.
Well, now
this is dangerous thinking, Preston.
Huh?
I mean, you know, President Trump, whether you love the man or whether you despise the man, he's not going to change the weather patterns, is he?
No.
I mean, you know, he's not going to stop a hurricane or an ice storm or another derecho or, you know, all these weird, you know, types of weather.
Or a zinc plant kept catching on fire.
Yeah, he's not going to be able to stop an earthquake or, you know, any of that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And so I think people have just, the people that are seeing the handwriting on the wall, like you said, I mean, they're done. You know, they got their feet up. They bought everything they wanted to buy.
Mm-hmm.
Now they're thinking about other stuff.
Yeah.
And, you know, people are transitioning to the homesteader movement. You know, this kind of, you know, back to the land thing that we kind of saw in like the 60s and 70s. I think that's having a massive resurgence right now. And, you know, it's still preparedness.
Yeah.
It's just through a very different mindset. And it's got a whole different attitude, which, I mean, it's fascinating to try to figure it out, but I don't know if we'll ever figure it out completely.
Yeah.
But, you know, it is what it is. So,
it sure
you know,
is.
I'm thankful that I was in it when I was, you know, and that gave me an opportunity to, you know, write all these books and get this information out there that I've been putting together for really my whole life. But, you know, especially the last 30 years of it. And, I'm very curious to see where it will go next. I don't have a crystal ball on my bookshelf here. I just got a bunch of books and just a lantern and a bunch of odds and ends. You know, I don't have a crystal ball, but, you know, I wonder what will be the next thing.
Yeah.
Like, you know, is it going to be, you know, the year before the next presidential election? Is that when people will get nervous again and maybe start to go back to survival stuff? You know, or are we just seeing, you know, it peaked and the bubble popped and it's gone for a while. You know, I just don't know.
Well, I have an intelligence background, so I look at the geopolitical environment. I try to analyze everything that I see and read and understand how things could affect our lives here in locally, in our state, in our nation, and the world. And that's kind of how I build things, because I want to make sure my wife is safe. So that was my impetus to take my blinders off and start looking at things more realistically. I see things coming. I don't want to make any predictions here, but I see things coming that are potentially bad geopolitically. I see possible economic collapse or at least hard times. There's a lot of things that are man-made that we can be in trouble with. And, you know, one of the things that I learned in the military and my law enforcement background was to take a worst case scenario and use that as a model to, you know, if we were going to go on an operation, what would be the worst case scenario? And then try and mitigate those factors that would either make it a worst case scenario or make it less worst case scenario. And so that's what I've been trying to do ever since I woke and started being aware of being prepared myself, because I never worried about myself because I knew I could handle whatever happened. But, you know, now that I have a wife, we got married in 2012, I have to make sure that she's safe. So
yeah,
that's when I realized, Preston, you better step up. So that's when I started really paying attention and trying to apply the things that I looked at and, you know, use it for our safety and security. And so, you know, there's always those natural occurrences. You know, here in Central Virginia, we have earthquakes every once in a while. Some of them, we're on a fault line, so we could have a very, very severe one. But everybody needs to be prepared for any type of emergency. You're not preparing for the emergency so much as you're preparing for the effects of emergency. And so some of that may be, you know, your house burns down. Well, now what? What are the effects? Well, you don't have a place to sleep. You don't have any food. You don't have any, you know, unless your vehicle was outside the garage, you don't have a vehicle anymore. So now you got to figure out what to do. And so that's the kind of things that I see that we need to prepare for. And it sounds like that's what you teach in a lot of ways. And your being on this show has highlighted some of that philosophy, I think, and it shows that your training and the skills that you offer through your courses and books match up to the basic mission of civil defense. And what we're trying to promote on a national scale here at Civil Defense Radio is going back to a civil defense kind of structure that is modernized to meet today's threats and environment. And so I guess that's it in a nutshell, how I see things, what I look at and try to glean information to make my decisions on what I do and where I go.
Yeah. And I think it's so admirable that you're taking this opportunity to try to help people. You know, most people, they go through life just worried about number one, me, gimme. You know, and maybe they take care of their spouse or, you know, their kids or their loved ones. Maybe they don't. And people like you who are stepping up, they are seeing a need that other people just are blind to.
Yeah.
They just can't see the need for it. They can't be bothered with it.
Exactly.
But you're giving them one more opportunity. You know, I mean, you're sticking your hand out. You're reaching for them. You're trying to pull them into the life raft. You know, this might be their last chance because we don't know what tomorrow holds. We just don't. That's our lot in life. You know, we blunder through in the darkness. We don't know what is going to happen next. Maybe it's a blessing. Maybe it's a curse. I would wager that it's a blessing because, you know, if we all knew when we're going to drop dead and exactly how it's going to happen, it would probably ruin the rest of our lives.
Yeah.
And I think it's really a blessing that we don't know that the sword of Damocles is hanging over our head by a thin, taut thread,
yes.
You know, just ready to break and drop.
Yes.
We as a nation, you know, we just kind of go about our own stuff and we don't worry about it too much. And most people don't worry about it ever. But
yeah.
But you're trying to get people to just wake up, recognize, you know what? Nobody's going to take care of me like I can.
Exactly.
Nobody will take care of my kids in the manner and with the speed that I think my kids deserve. So it's going to have to be me. I'm going to have to step up. I'm going to have to make some choices. You know, I'm going to have to look at what our threats are, the most reasonable threats, you know, the most likely problems that would occur. I'm going to look at those. I'm going to look at solutions for those. And 9 times out of 10, it's all the same.
Yes.
You know, whether you're worried about the grid going down or, you know, you're worried about, you know, this type of weather event or, you know, earthquakes or whatever you're concerned about, you know, as a threat to you and your family. The preps are the same. You know, you still need water, you still need food, you need a way to cook, you need communication, you need first aid, you need safety and security, mm-hmm. and basic hygiene and sanitation and just a few other things.
And networking.
And networking, yes. It's not what you know, but who you know sometimes.
Yes, you can't defend your house 24/7. You got to have your neighborhood is your strongest asset in a crisis, because, you know, if something, let's say a tree falls on your house, and you're pinned and you can't get out. Well, hopefully your neighbors will see something and they'll come over and say, "Hey, what's going on, Preston? You guys need any help?" You got to have community. That's what it's all about. It's all about developing that sense of community that we've lost, and is in many places. I don't know if it'll ever come back, but hopefully in the most neighborhoods have the ability to develop that and keep that alive.
Yeah. Well, I hope you're right. I mean, that is something that you know we desperately need as a nation, some semblance of community and neighborliness. Because right now everybody's just shut up in their own little box, and you know they don't know who their neighbors are or what they're all about, and that causes apathy.
Yes.
If you don't know who your neighbors are or what they're all about, you don't care what your neighbors are going through or what their problems are. And yeah, I mean, I hate to say it, but I think it would take a major shakeup to get people to realize the value of their neighbors, you know, the merit of having other people around who also want to take care of, you know, their families and the neighborhood. But let's hope it doesn't ever come to that. You know, let's hope everybody just keeps on stumbling down the sidewalk with their nose buried in their smartphone. And, you know, the worst thing they have to worry about is deciding what they're going to have for lunch. I want to thank you again for this opportunity to be on your show. I want to thank you for what you are doing for the national community, you know, not just your neighborhood, but your neighbors throughout the United States. And I also want to remind people that books are great. Watching YouTube is great. You know, watching survival TV shows is great. But nothing beats hands-on training. Nothing beats it. And so for those that are in the Mid-Atlantic region, I'd encourage you to check out the classes that I run in survival and self-reliance. You can go to advancedsurvivaltraining.com. That's advanced with a D, survivaltraining.com. And you can look at my whole list of classes that I offer year-round.